When historians talk about this era, they will emphasize the colossal policy failures.
What we model is not always in line with how people reason, whether it's on what's fair or on how things should be, or even on how things are.
Governments will need to take a more active role in the economy, and policies considered eccentric, such as basic income and wealth taxes, will have to be in the mix.
Today on Vox Talks, capitalism after COVID. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Well, last year, as the world went into lockdown, the CEPR's Luis Garicano, one of that rare breed of economists who also find success in politics, decided to conduct a series of interviews with his fellow economists around the world about the future of capitalism. The transcripts of 21 of those interviews are now published in a new ebook from the CEPR, and they make fascinating reading both for the wide range of topics they consider and the fresh thinking that emerges. And Luis joins me today. Welcome to Vox Talks.
Very, very nice to be here.
Very pleased to have you here as well. Luis, the first thing you have to explain to me is why on earth, at a time when everyone was running around just trying to cope with everyday life, did you decide to commit to doing these interviews?
I was as well running around. We were working very hard in the European Parliament trying to get a recovery plan for Europe together. But I also thought that this would be what Taro Masimoglu later in one of the interviews has called a critical juncture, a moment where really we get a chance to rethink everything we're doing. There is going to be a before and after. The example comes to mind is the Second World War, where economists and policymakers were thinking during the years 42, 43 about what the right monetary arrangements after the war would be. And there are two big policy innovations that come out of that particular critical juncture, which are Bretton Woods and welfare state.
But the economists you've spoken to, they have pretty established views when you're talking about people like Daron or Danny Roderick or John Cochrane. Did you believe that they're really taking a fresh look at what they believe about capitalism?
Some of what happens in a crisis like this is it really makes things that were already happening at some level, they make them more salient and more serious. So in some sense, monetary arrangements weren't found in the Second World War to be wrong. It's just that they were already wrong for two decades, and the war gives you the impulse to change them. And this is most notable in the case of inequality. Many of the economists that we interview were already very concerned about inequality. They were already thinking that this is really the critical fault line, as Gregor Regan has called it, in our world economy, and that it needs fixing. There are certain things on which there is a clear change, and the most important one has to do with debt and with the fiscal sustainability of a large fiscal expansion. There really is, immediately from the first moments of this crisis, a very large consensus among economists who had been bickering in the previous crisis about austerity. In this crisis, there was no such a bickering. There was a clear consensus that we needed to do whatever it takes, that we needed a big fiscal expansion, or we needed to think about debt later. And I think there, the move is pretty large and universal in all economists on all sides of the spectrum.
There is a consensus about what the problems are, but looking further ahead, do you think there is a consensus among them about what the solution to this might be, how we should rethink capitalism?
There are some solutions, something I would call maybe a Brussels consensus, that have been observed in Europe and now with Biden as well in the United States, that have to do with an effort to build a more sustainable capitalist system that has investments in green and climate and fighting climate change at its core, and that looks for really tackling wage and wealth inequality. At a global level, there are two sources of free riding that countries have really decided to tackle, or that I am hoping they are deciding to tackle. One has to do with climate change, where some countries do a lot and some countries don't do anything. And the other one has to do with taxation, where basically some countries have decided to become tax havens and where essentially nobody does anything to discourage them. There are many countries, particularly in the Caribbean, but also in Europe, which basically make their living out of helping others evade taxes. And I think that those are two big elements on a global scale that we need to tackle. We need to eliminate free riding. On a national scale, we need to deal with inequality and ensure kind of more sustainable growth.
You mentioned Daron Acemoglu at the beginning, and leading on from that, one of the things that really struck me in the transcripts was he talked about colossal policy and institutional failures that had been exposed by the pandemic. But on the other hand, we could be pretty pleased about the initial institutional response in many countries to what happened in the pandemic. Should we be focusing on these failures that Daron points out, or should we be congratulating ourselves on the successes that we made?
It's true that ultimately we have gotten a vaccine in a relatively short period of time, and shorter than many people feared. Mm. We have managed to see, at least we are seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. Although as we speak now, India is an example that the pandemic is certainly not yet under control. I think, as Acemoglu was pointing out, there are two things that are quite clear. First, there were some policy failures that were already there that laid the ground to a situation where we weren't able to respond. And they have to do with mostly populism, particularly he was concerned about the United States and the fact that the CDC and other institutions basically were hollowed out by the lack of expertise and the assault on expertise. There were also new policy failures that meant that the entire world was kind of reacting in separate ways with little coordination. And we see them now with the vaccines, where third world countries and poor countries are struggling. So I would agree with him that these, what he's calling fault lines, what he's calling these colossal failures, were there, and that we need to take them in and make changes. He suggests four different kinds of solutions. He suggests a capitalism that goes towards weaker institutions and that lets everything rot. He says that's obviously bad, but possible. A China-light strategy where we're going towards a more authoritarian system modeled on China. We're all hoping that's not going to happen, although some European countries seem to be going in that direction, like Hungary. He also thinks like some countries might fixate on corporations as the solution and let a kind of a strong corporate state run amok. And that's kind of incompatible with our values in terms of privacy and antitrust. And then he talks about a better one where there is a stronger social safety net, where we trust expertise in institutions become stronger. And that's the kind of capitalism he's looking for. And I think that when things like this happen, we really have a chance to kind of sit down and think which of these options, and these four, I think, are a pretty reasonable list, are we going to walk through. And I hope indeed the fourth is the one.
Well, if there is a stronger safety net, and if we do have more government borrowing and spending, at least in the medium term, then we have what you call in the book the new Leviathan, a bigger state. Do you consider the state will be permanently bigger now because of what we've learned from the pandemic?
It does look like almost everywhere we're going to have higher levels of debt and higher levels of taxation. What we need to make sure is that doesn't become a reason to restrict our freedoms in many areas. We see it very clearly, for example, in the use of tracking technologies that were introduced with the aim of fighting the pandemic and that have become common places in places like China. The objective should be to counter this growth of the state with a stronger democracy, with more competition, with more decentralization in all of those public bureaucracies, with more responsive bureaucracies to citizens. And very importantly, as said by several of our guests, like Wendy Cullen, by giving a much stronger role to the civil society, by ensuring that the community becomes also stronger and more resilient.
Wendy and also Raghuram Rajan, they point to the attention that needs to be paid to concepts like fairness and altruism. This hasn't been something that's been very present in economics over the last couple of decades. Should we be thinking about a new economics as well as new policy thinking that pays more attention to these concepts?
This is indeed Wendy Carlin's claim. Mm. She has been extremely influential in rethinking how economics is taught and rethinking what economics should be doing. Her view is that we tend to think in terms of a dichotomy between state and the market. That actually leaves out a crucial area where the incentives are neither compulsion, somebody's telling you what to do, nor just individual maximization like in the market, but instead, there is a community, she calls it, that works together and that has indeed motivations such as altruism and reciprocity, etc. She talks about basically three or four paradigms that affect both the world of policy and the world of economics. And she asks for a new paradigm. She talks about kind of an old liberal, classical liberal paradigm, which was based on around values of freedom and equality and dignity, an economic model of specialization, division of labor, the policies of free trade. And she says that moved to Keynesianism, where the values were more of security and shared prosperity, where the economic model was the full employment Keynesian model. The policy framework was aggregate demand management. She says we went back to what she calls a neoliberal paradigm, which is the one that was introduced basically with the Reagan-Thatcher years in the world and the dominance of the Chicago School in economics and neoclassical economics. And she says, look, we now need to move towards a, and that was around kind of similar values as the classical paradigm, with this emphasis on individualism and self-interest and free capital mobility, etc. And she says, look, we need to move towards a new paradigm where we have this third pole, this community civil society based on reciprocity, altruism, fairness, and both in the world of policymaking and in the world of economics, those two things need to move. And that's something that she not only has argued for, but she has actually pushed very strongly with a beautiful project that I'm sure you've had in this show at some point, which is the CORE, the curriculum open access resources, which she tries to teach students not just what the principles of economics that have traditionally been taught, but also what economists actually do right now, which involves a lot about asymmetric information and all sorts of important pressing problems like climate change or inequality.
This reminds me of Danny Roderick's interview that he did with you, where he's talking about a new globalization that takes into account things like global public goods. And one of those would be vaccination. Well, the problem that's shown up now is vaccine nationalism. Is this a problem that economists can address, or is this always political?
A lot, indeed, of the economists in the interviews, this is a running theme from the entire book, is worry very much about how we're going to manage globalization without the US there to decide the punishments and rewards for those who don't behave or behave badly. The example that one of those gives is the 3M. The moment where the US actually says, no, an American company should produce for America. This was under Trump. And the US was not behaving as the good cop of the world. It was behaving as a self-interest actor. And once you have a self-interested actor like the US that strong, and everybody else is going a lot for themselves, then the question is, can globalization survive? Can we have a global system in which basically there are no institutions that can impose certain behaviors? Danny Roderick, indeed, is one of the people who discusses the new globalization. And he is kind of striking how he's pretty optimistic about a globalization which is based less on institutions, which is a little bit what he calls a thinner globalization. He thinks we've gone too far in certain things, and he singles out one of the ones that would be relevant to your question immediately, which is IP protection. He thinks there's been too much of an effort to impose intellectual property rules on everybody in the world. And he says that is a corporate globalization. Globalization has been too driven by preserving the interests of corporations. He says, and we have gone not far enough in certain things that actually do need a strong globalization. He singles out particularly climate, health, obviously pandemics would be one. And he says, look, in this type of issues, we do need strong institutions. I think what economics can help here is in differentiating where is reciprocity enough, where are countries able to kind of achieve a certain good outcome by being left to their own devices. And Roderick insists things like trade. It's in my interest, it's in your interest, we will both trade. And where that's not going to happen, and there is a risk that if we just leave countries to find reciprocal arrangements, they're going to fail. And he points out two reasons for that. Public goods, particularly climate, is a global public good. And what he calls bigger than ever policies, which are like taxation, where each country is kind of interested in trying to steal tax revenue from other countries. And in those cases, some thicker globalization is needed. Whereas in the other ones, it's kind of a thin globalization where you make a bilateral deal and everybody's individual interests are going to line up.
Let's talk about your day job, Lewis, as a member of parliament in Europe. Last time we had a crisis, then a lot of people again were saying we have to rethink how we do policy. What is good policy? And that was followed by, I think, what most people would consider now to be a colossal policy failure in Europe. We just couldn't agree on doing things differently. Is it going to be different this time within European policymaking?
I think there is a very clear desire and very clear sense that things are going to be different. It's maybe still not clear if they're going to be better, but they're going to be different. And I would point out several areas where you can see European Parliament is a great place to see consensus shifts, because you have all countries, all ideologies, you have pretty articulate people, and you get a chance to hear it. In the political grouping where I see it, which is the center grouping, there's both kind of the French center, Macron, and the kind of more classical liberal Dutch center, which is Rutte. And you see these two poles, the progressive liberalism and the more classical liberalism, kind of coming to grips with this. And my sense is that, first, from the European perspective, we've had common debt issuance, which was unthinkable. The Eurobonds, if you remember, was the big discussion of a previous crisis. Now, we actually do have these Eurobonds financing the recovery plan. Second, we have clear sense of some investments which are good for Europe as a whole, and those have been singled out as climate and digitalization. And third, you have this big investment plan being embarked upon with big reforms for Europe as well. And I think if you consider all of these elements, you do see this, what I've called this emerging kind of process consensus, this idea that we're going to do things in a different way. We're going to try to use this opportunity to create a more livable and more sustainable economy for all. And I think that this is a very, very wide consensus. You can see it from left to right. Let's see if it's sustained and if it's manageable. And if it happens without creating this new Leviathan we were talking about, this gigantic state that actually is more oppressive and restricts freedoms.
You're in the room now when policies are made because you are part politician. But how do other economists influence that policy debate as the decisions are made? Because often that's been their frustration. How can they change that?
I think economists tend to think only on policy, and they don't tend to think of what are the politics behind that policy, what is the real political economy, the set of interests that are behind. And also, they don't tend to think very much of how you communicate, how do you manage to win the communication battle. Maybe the most important lesson I've learned here has to do with framing. Maybe the most important lesson here is how the debate is often not won on the actual points, definitely not won on the statistics, but on the field where the fight is being fought. The famous examples coming from the US about pro-life and pro-choice, where if you're talking about life, then nobody is going to be against life. So the moment the frame is, are you pro-life or not, then certain set of people win. And this is similarly in economic policies. When you talk about raising taxes, there's never going to be good frame, and you'd have to talk about more public investment. Both things are two sides of the same coin, but that's the frame that helps. And it's very good, obviously, that economics always has to be factual. It always has to be analytical. It always has to be data-based. But we have to be much, much better at understanding how policy debates are won and lost. And they are not won and lost on the basis of some very sophisticated evidence. One thing I learned to do was the one chart approach, right? What is the one chart? That is simple. Let's say I have seven lines. There's one, maybe just two boxes, two rectangles, one's longer than the other. But that everybody can understand what that one chart is. I remember Dick Feder talking about frames in Chicago, and he made this example about Coke doing an experiment in which you could either say, I'm going to double the prices of Coke in the summer, in the machines of selling Coke in the summer. And people are like, what? This is outrageous. When we need more, the cold drinks, they are twice as expensive. Or I can halve the price of the drinks in the winter. And that's very kind of you to halve the price of drinks in the winter. The two are the same price path, obviously, but they are just framed differently. And these issues take a lot of subtlety, and they are much, much more of an art than what we usually learn in economics, which is doing regressions and presenting data and doing math. But sadly, they are absolutely essential to public communication.
So, Luis, thank you for your own contribution to communication. Thank you for producing this book.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks very, very much.
If you want to read these interviews, well, the ebook's a free download. It's called Capitalism After COVID, Conversations with 21 Economists. The editor, of course, is Luis Garicano. And if you want to watch the videos of these interviews, then go to Luis's website. That's luisgaricano.eu/videos. This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks and you'll never miss an episode. And remember, you can find 12 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.